Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. So I put it to the assembled. Imagine if today's technology existed in the 19th century, a mechanism whereby the citizenry could converse with one another about the most discussed items of the day, phrenology, petticoats, cupping. And people, and not just the cosseted elites would know these things. It would be diffuse and dispersed to the masses. Alas, they did not have this technology to discuss the most interesting topics.
Cupping.
And they withered away their time on novels like The Brothers Karamazov and David Copperfield.
What a waste of time.
But thankfully we, in the 21st century, have it. And we call it the most.
Indeed.
So our list of most emailed and most sent around the internet starts with Ian. What do you have, Ian?
I have a most popular from Tampa Bay 10, local CBS affiliate there in Tampa Bay.
Yes.
Turns out this teacher, Jim Pekulis, you know, he's entertaining. He's a sub, substitute teacher. You know, it's always hard to win over the kids when you're a sub. So.
Especially if your name is Pekulis.
Mr. Pekulis. Call me Jim.
It's actually misspelled in this article as peculiar, which is sad for him. But anyway, so you know, it's hard to win over the kids. He's like, hey, I know magic tricks. Can do some magic tricks. He does this trick where he takes a toothpick in his hand, makes it disappear, and then reappear.
Okay.
I saw him do it on
pretty
the
clever.
Online.
Yeah?
It's pretty awesome.
Uh-huh.
I don't know where that toothpick went.
Wow.
Anyway, so after he does this, he gets called into the office. The supervisor of substitute teachers says, sorry.
It's a very prestigious position, by the way.
You're not needed anymore. You're being accused of wizardry.
No way.
Yes, he was fired for wizardry.
Can't win for losing.
The assistant superintendent for Pasco County School District says there were some other issues in addition to the wizardry, something about like allowing kids to use computers they weren't authorized for. He said, the teacher, Pekulis, says he didn't hear anything about anything but the wizardry.
I was just told
it's
wizardry.
It's just the wizardry.
They have an anti-warlock policy in that school district, though.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. You know, I don't know what this guy's going to do now.
It's hard out there for a witch.
Hogwarts?
There's Hogwarts. Maybe they're taking applications? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Just have to put on his sorting cap and see what happens. Rachel, what do you have?
Mine's one of the most emailed at CNN.com. Isabella Rossellini, you know her, very pretty actress, beautiful woman, talented. She's been in Blue Velvet, that film, the TV series Alias. She is now taking on a very bizarre role.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just read the first line of the article. When it comes to sex, Isabella Rossellini is an animal. A spider, an earthworm, and a fly. These are just some of the creatures that she is impersonating in her new project called Green Porno. Seriously, these are a series of short films commissioned by the Sundance Channel looking at how these little creatures get down to the business of reproducing. They're only 2 minutes long. She hopes you learn something along the way, like the fact that the praying mantis lady always eats the dude after she does her business or
his business. It happens. Hey, praying mantis
harsh,
is what I do.
Harsh, man.
So she's playing the spider?
She plays all the main characters.
Who's
the
playing
the
male
costume,
praying mantis?
A cardboard box.
Steve Buscemi.
Cutouts.
They're all cutouts.
Oh, really?
She said the hardest costume to wear was the worm because her hands were restricted.
And one of the hardest breakdancing moves as well. Yeah,
that's true.
All right, well.
Yeah. Green porno, there you have it.
Dan,
I've got a most email here from the St. Pete Times. Now, just yesterday we got into a conversation on the most about really bad beers. Well, we found this article by a man named Joey Redner, who is a Tampa resident and a world beer traveler, according to the paper, which is a title I aspire to. And the headline is Poor Health, P-O-U-R. The only label on these beers. Puns don't work on the radio. You have to spell them.
Yeah.
Anyway, he has his top 10 worst beers in the world.
Now, yesterday it came up because Trisha was talking about Genesee Cream Ale, and Ian said that was one of the worst. I put forth Keystone. What's on any of those on the list?
The only one that even fits into that oeuvre is Milwaukee's Best, which comes in at number 9. He writes, I understand this is a sentimental favorite. Takes him back to the old days. Well, human sacrifice harkens to a simpler time, too. If you want to kill your taste buds, try battery acid. It probably tastes better.
What's his worst of the worst?
Well, I'll get to that second. Okay. Another one on the list is called Cave Creek Chili Beer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, that doesn't sound bad.
Yeah.
Oh, you think it sounds
really
good?
Sure, a little chili?
I didn't need
kick?
To read the explanation here of why that would be bad. I'm pretty convinced it's bad, but
Basically, microbrew.
He puts this beer has a whole chili pepper inside the beer.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
At least it's not a gimmick.
Oh, yeah.
But the top three, number three, Chapeau Exotic, which is a lambic Belgian beer. Number two, Camo Genuine Ale. And the worst beer in the world, according to Joey Redner, Busch Non-Alcoholic Beer. Which is sort of, non-alcoholic beer making the number one. I mean,
yeah, especially when it's based on Bush.
Yeah, right. One more most I have for you real quick is off the Google Trends, number seven, cyclone versus hurricane. This refers to the situation in Myanmar. Now, listeners to the BPP heard us explain this yesterday morning, but in response to that question, a cyclone and a hurricane are the same thing in terms of what kind of storm they are, as is a typhoon. It just depends on where it happens. Hurricane is in around the U.S. and the Americas, typhoon in Asia, cyclone in Indian Ocean.
Right.
A tornado is smaller and over land.
It's like a zither and an otter harp.
Exactly.
Jeannie.
Well, my most is from Yahoo News. Mildred Loving, known as the matriarch of interracial marriage, has died. She was 68 years old. And her landmark case in 1967 overturned laws, struck down laws banning racially mixed marriages in 17 states. She was 11 years old when she met Richard, who was 17, and they began courting in Virginia. And a few years later, they had to go to Washington, D.C. to get married when she was 18. She said she had no idea it was illegal for them to get married, but they were arrested within weeks of returning home to Virginia. And they ultimately had to plead guilty to cohabitating as a man and wife against the peace and dignity of the Commonwealth, according to their indictments. So they were forced to move back to Washington, D.C. in order to avoid going to jail. And they appealed to Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General at the time. He referred them over to the ACLU, and they won in 1967.
Loving versus Virginia, landmark Supreme Court case struck down anti-miscegenation laws. I believe she got divorced later, but she still stands by that. Is that right?
It didn't say that she got divorced.
Okay.
It said that he died in a car accident in 1975.
So
but apparently she was a pretty private person. Nevertheless, Loving Day events around the country mark the advances of mixed-race couples.
And I have the most emailed on the BBC, Waltzing Matilda, the unofficial national anthem of Australia, not a socialist song. Did you know people thought it was a socialist song?
Yeah. No idea. I had never made that mistake.
Yeah, well, if you were Australian, you would, I mean, it's one of these songs that is imbued with so many meanings, and at about the time it was written, it was in response to a shearer's strike in 1895, and some of the lyrics are involving stealing a sheep, and the protagonist of the song drowns himself in a lake. Mm. It's also a great song because it has so much old Australian slang. Can we hear a little of that?
Once a jolly swagman sat beside the billabong under the shade of the coolibah tree, and he sang as he sat and waited by the billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me.
All right, Waltzing Matilda means just carrying around your rucksack and your billy is your thing that boiled. And the author of a book says that the guy who wrote this song, a man with the nickname Banjo, just did it to impress a girl. So that was the
Ain't
most.
Ain't it always so?
That's
Ain't
how most things are done.
So. Yep. And what do you got, Matt?
I have one of the most emailed at npr.org right now. It's a story about taco trucks, one of my favorite things in the world. It's a story reported by NPR's Ben Bergman in Los Angeles, where it's now illegal to park a taco truck in any one place for more than an hour.
This is scandalous.
It is, considering how many taco trucks there are in Los Angeles. Here's Ben's story.
LA's most famous restaurant critic gets paid to eat wherever he wants. Yet several times a week, Jonathan Gold pulls over to the side of the road and eats cuisine served on a paper plate out of a truck.
I've probably been to 3,000 or 4,000 taco trucks in my life. It's a hobby, you might say.
Gold, the only food critic to have won a Pulitzer Prize, says most of the time the tacos are so delicious that even if he intends to take them home to his family, he can't help but devour the tacos in the time it takes to walk from the truck to his car.
If I had to eat only one taco for the rest of my life, it would probably be a perfect taco al pastor with marinated pork, cooked on a revolving spit in front of a live fire, the crispy bubbly bits carved off to order, put in a thing with hot salsa, and a little tiny sliver of roasted pineapple from the top of the skewer.
But not everyone is so enamored of taco trucks, known to their critics as roach coaches. L.A. County recently passed new laws that will make it a misdemeanor to park a taco truck in the same place for more than an hour, punishable with a $1,000 fine or 6 months in jail. The county already has similar rules on the books, but they only carry a $60 fine and are rarely enforced. The harsher laws are in response to complaints from business owners like Maria Melgar, who says taco trucks have made her life miserable.
Oh, a lot of problems. Mucho problema.
Melgar owns the Birria Guadalajara in East L.A. She serves only one kind of meat, slow-cooked goat. At a recent lunch hour, the dimly lit restaurant was nearly empty, save for a man sitting at the center table, and he was there for an interview.
My name is Luis Herrera. I'm the president of the Greater East Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce.
Herrera, who represents 70 restaurants, says taco trucks, or catering trucks as he prefers to call them, deliberately park in front of successful restaurants and steal away customers.
After 6 o'clock, this restaurant is closed because that's the hour that the catering trucks come in. They can't compete with the prices of the catering trucks. Their prices are so much less because their overhead is zero.
Herrera suspects many taco trucks don't pay taxes and don't pay attention to health and safety.
That's not competition. That's not being fair.
Herrera has been in this area, East L.A., for nearly 40 years, selling used cars across the street. The population here is 98% Hispanic, and the streets are home to hundreds of taco trucks. No neighborhood is more affected by the new rules than East L.A. At Tacos El Galuzu, down the street from Birria Guadalajara, customers are lined up to buy 90-cent tacos al pastor or asada quesadillas for $3.25. Juan Torres, originally from Mexico, has owned this truck for 7 years and works here every night of the week. He's still paying off his truck, which costs $70,000. Should the health department come by, as it does every couple months, he keeps the truck immaculately clean.
I have everything permits. I pay taxes, been the license.
Despite the fact they're mobile, most taco trucks, including this one, park on the same street every night. Torres even pays hundreds of dollars in rent to the business he parks in front of. He says the new laws could ruin his business because he depends on repeat customers who always know where to find him.
And the people come in, don't see me, he can go another place, another restaurant, you know.
Torres and other truck owners have hired an attorney, Philip Greenwald, to challenge the rules.
The potential of a jail sentence and or a $1,000 fine for parking to sell food, that's a bit overkill. It's ridiculous. It's outrageous.
While Greenwald pursues a legal strategy, truck owners are forming a taco resistance. When the rules go into effect May 15th, over 100 taco truck owners vow to stay parked right where they are.
That's NPR's Ben Bergman reporting from Los Angeles. There are links that will lead you to the best taco trucks in LA at our website, npr.org/BryantPark.